Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson with my co-host Celia Farber. Today we have a very, very special guest. Julian Assange is back in the headlines. Of course, everyone knows he was indicted on 18 charges of publishing classified documents. But by now, everyone also knows that there has been a second superseding indictment that the Justice Department filed last month against Assange that doesn't add new charges, but it broadens the time frame and scope of what they now claim is Assange's conspiracy to solicit secret documents, recruit hackers to steal them, and then publishing them, thereby, of course, endangering lives and national security. Now, if you read the indictment without knowing anything, you might be impressed by the case that they lay out. But the devil is in the details, and if you talk to good journalists, like our guest who's going to come on, who's been following the Assange case and who knows the ins and outs of who did what and when, you'll discover sordid FBI activities and lies upon which this document was crafted, including how some crimes outlined in the indictment were actually carried out by paid FBI informants, how claims made in the indictment conveniently ignored timelines to make Assange look like he was part of getting leaked information when he couldn't have been, and how Assange's efforts to help Edward Snowden after he became a WikiLeaks source is now being characterized as a criminal act, and much more. Our guest today is one of those good journalists, and he's going to unpack the indictment for us. His name is Kevin Gastola, and he's the managing editor for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the Unauthorized Disclosure Weekly podcast. He contributed to the book In Defense of Julian Assange, and his work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, Alternet, Common Dreams, and Mint Press News. He was one of the few journalists to regularly report on Chelsea Manning's court-martial and has covered all things WikiLeaks extensively since 2010, as well as the U.S. government's wider war on whistleblowers. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
So, in your article, U.S. government expands Assange indictment to criminalize assistance provided to Edward Snowden, you wrote about how the government's prosecutors are relying heavily on statements made by two FBI informants to expand the scope of the prosecution. First of all, give us a little background on this superseding indictment, and then just seg right into these two shady characters.
Yeah, I think it's important for those who are listening to your show to recognize that from December 2010, there was a grand jury that was impaneled by the Justice Department under President Barack Obama that was essentially set up to investigate. And in my view, it was there to try and destroy the WikiLeaks organization, because effectively they wanted to find a way to criminalize what was happening with the publications that were disclosures from Chelsea Manning. Of course, Chelsea Manning is the most famous, well-known source of information, of documents that were published by WikiLeaks. And she herself is a laudable person and very well respected and has shown a lot of courage in standing up to the government, especially in this case, which we might get to. But there were documents that were published in 2010, particularly there were war log documents from Afghanistan and Iraq that were military incident reports. There were diplomatic cables that WikiLeaks began to publish from a batch of around 250,000 diplomatic cables. And so this department...
Well, that collateral damage video, I think, is really what did it, too.
No, and there's that, too. I meant to include that as well. And that one has a more visceral impact because you get to actually see the images of horrific war playing out and the way in which soldiers are. This was the way that Chelsea described it.
Well, you're watching war crimes happen, you know.
Yeah. Chelsea described during her own court-martial how she saw this kind of bloodlust that existed in these soldiers and was offended by it. And so this grand jury was set up to investigate. It called people to the grand jury from any associates of WikiLeaks were invited to testify or subpoenaed to testify. They went after these people and tried to get them to inform on WikiLeaks. And ultimately, they didn't proceed forward with this because Barack Obama and his Justice Department understood that there was something they called the New York Times problem, which was if they prosecuted WikiLeaks, then they would probably have to go after editors and other people at the media organization who were involved in the publication of these documents. Yeah. And so they backed off. So I don't give them credit, but I think you have to distinguish the Obama administration from the Trump administration, and it's very clear. One went up to the line, and the other crossed it. They went up to the line and decided that they weren't going to issue charges against Julian Assange, but they could have. And there was always mumblings that there was a sealed indictment, and there was a really a conviction on the part of Julian Assange's legal team that he could be indicted at any moment, which is why he sought asylum in the Ecuador embassy. And then you come to 2016, and Donald Trump becomes president, and he appoints as his attorney general Jeff Sessions, who has a total hatred and loathing for leaks. He's one of the few senators in the history of the recent history of the Senate who backed legislation that would have created an Official Secrets Act in the United States, which is essentially like if you publish leaks, you've just committed a crime. So if you publish classified information, they would have a way to go after people for doing it. It wouldn't just go after government officials who publish. It would criminalize publishing state secrets that were sensitive. And so he reopens this grand jury that lay dormant. And I think this was the fault of the Obama administration, that they didn't have a press conference, officially end this grand jury and officially end the investigation into WikiLeaks. So it was easy to just rev it back up. And then the charges were put together. And we saw new subpoenas. We saw Chelsea Manning hauled before the grand jury, and she refused to testify and served and was in jail for about a year resisting. Jeremy Hammond, another source, he was involved in the hack of Stratfor documents, which we're going to get into here when we talk about these two shady characters. Stratfor was this private intelligence consulting firm that held itself out as being, I think, much more important than it really was. It claimed to have a lot of coziness with people within government institutions, but it was really peddling a third grade product. It wasn't really all that it was cracked up to be. But we saw in these files that there were some of these Stratfor individuals that had some details about what were going on in government. Those were published and those were obtained through a hack that Jeremy Hammond participated in, and that the FBI was
overseen by one of those FBI informants, right?
Yes. Yeah. So there was an FBI informant, and I guess we could start with him. His name is Hector. Hector Monsignor, his name is Sabu. He's known as Sabu on the internet. And so, he's involved in this. And I think the reason why I go through all of the setup talking about the grand jury is because it's important for people to understand that Jeremy Hammond refused to testify, never testified, was allowed to, basically the grand jury was dismissed back in March. And so he was returned to the Bureau of Prisons custody, and he's finishing up his federal prison sentence that he received for being involved in the hack.
Let's explain to our listeners that Jeremy is a hacker, right? And he was working for Hector, for Sabu, right?
He's working with, he was, I mean, I think it's better to say working with, that he was collaborating. He was part of a collective of people.
Sabu was picking the targets and he was hacking them, right?
Yes. But he also did, I mean, he was doing his own stuff before Hector came along. But what's important to the story is that Hector's the one that suggests going after Stratfor as a target,
right,
and going after them. But Jeremy is successfully resists the grand jury and they don't get any testimony. The same as can be said for Chelsea Manning. She successfully resisted, was allowed to go, and they don't, and they did not get any additional testimony from her beyond what she had already said during her court martial. And that means, what do you have to rely on? You have to rely on your own paid informants, which both of them have aspects to their personalities, aspects to who they are, that make them likely impeachable witnesses, or people who you could undermine if they gave testimony during a trial against Julian Assange. But they use whatever they have said in order to expand the scope and now make this about more than just initially the indictment was about the source relationship that Julian Assange allegedly had with Chelsea Manning. It's now expanded to 2009 through 2015 and includes this. So to get into it, Hector was apparently involved in going after, he was someone who picked out this target. We have Del Cameron, who has done a lot of reporting on Jeremy Hammond's case, who points out that there are chat logs and surveillance photos, and there's government documents that basically show that Sabu is introducing Hammond to people who can go after and obtain the credit card database, that can do the kinds of things to go after Stratfor systems and bring them down. It's essentially Hector, it's Sabu, who gives this group AntiSec that people may have heard about, gives them access to the private intelligence firm system in December 2011. And then, as laid out by Del Cameron in his reporting, he says that he pushed Hammond and others to unknowingly transfer multiple gigabytes of confidential data to one of the FBI servers, and that included roughly 60,000 credit card number and records for Stratfor customers that Hammond was charged with stealing. So this is kind of stuff that there's really no public interest value to publishing, and this is really what prosecutors tend to go after people for hacking.
Well,
we need
to make clear to the audience, too, that's a violation of Department of Justice guidelines for FBI informants, because they can't be, and they paid him, but also they were surveilling him constantly. Okay, so they knew what he was doing, and they accepted his stolen stuff. FBI DOJ guidelines say the FBI is not allowed to let their informants initiate or instigate any plan or strategy to commit a federal, state, or local offense. Okay?
This is true. This is absolutely true. And, for those who follow these kinds of cases where entrapment becomes an issue, I mean, we've seen this, not to go off on a tangent, but we've seen this in the terrorism context with going after individuals who are basically young Muslim men who are manipulated into committing to plans to carry out certain attacks, and they're done so by informants planting these ideas in them and enticing them to engage in certain acts. And that's also what's happening here in the hacker context.
It's interesting that you say it's not actually a tangent, and I'll tell you why. The reason why they're upset about Chelsea Manning not coming back and testifying again is because one of their tricks is to have you testify a first time and then have you come back, testify a second time, and what you say the second time doesn't match necessarily what you say. If what you say the second time doesn't match what you say the first time, why then you've lied to the FBI. It's a form of entrapment.
Yeah, and her attorneys were very concerned that she was being set up for a perjury trap because they were suggesting...
That's exactly what I described.
They were suggesting that the government didn't believe her, that she was truthful when she gave a statement to the court. And she outlined in very extensive detail the way in which she selected documents, why she wanted to select those documents, how she contacted WikiLeaks, why she chose WikiLeaks, and the processes she used in order to send and transfer those documents. And it was pretty forensic, the kind of detail you get in a court case, in a major court case.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't need any more information from her. They just wanted to trap her. And so since they couldn't get her, they couldn't do that to Hammond, so they had to go pay for these two characters. I mean, really, you could see what happened here.
Yeah, they failed. Their grand jury did not get the goods, and they had to fall back on their paid informants. And they're honestly hard to treat as credible people. Another detail I'll work in here is that Sabu, apparently, according to Jeremy Hammond, if we believe him, and certainly I don't have any reason not to believe that he's been credible in this, he says that Sabu attempted to entrap WikiLeaks by suggesting that the organization pay him cash for the leaks. I think we're talking about the Stratfor files. But unbeknownst to him, WikiLeaks already had these documents and was going to publish them. And so, that's a key issue.
Go ahead.
No, the other thing I wanted to just throw out, which is Dell has brought to everyone's attention, and I think it's a crucial detail, that the timeline's off. It's actually several months before Assange is involved at all that this hack apparently takes place, but that you don't get that from the indictment. Obviously, they wouldn't want it to be that way. It'd be harder to try and tie him into being involved in working with hackers. And I mean, I guess the key point for people to take away is that they're directly attacking the right that journalists have, that publishers have, to publish the hacked materials, to publish stolen materials. Under the First Amendment, we have a recognized right to publish this material. And by going after him, it affects every single journalist, because they are undermining your ability to accept this information from sources.
Well, it's bigger than that, I feel, because not only are they doing that, but they're actually paying liars to help them out. Their informants are committing crimes and sending the results of the crime to them. They're lying in this indictment. I mean, they're implying that he was a conspirator in the breach, in the Stratfor breach, when he didn't even know about it for a very long time. Assange didn't even know about the breach for a long time. So how could he have actually, conspired or been part of that breach? And by the way, besides the Stratfor thing, remember also, while an FBI informant, Hector, or what's his name again? I forget his. I just think of him as Hector Monsegur, but Sabu was also involved in hacking all these various government files all over the world, you know,
yes.
while he was being surveilled by them. And, you
yeah.
know, I don't know if they got, did the FBI get the results of those hacks too?
So there's a lot that we don't know. I mean, there are journalists that have tried to get files from this case disclosed, and they're under lock and seal. And we may never know what the extent of his hacking was on behalf of the FBI. But I know that it involved foreign government websites as well. And that was hacking that the FBI knew was happening. I mean, and I also, you know, I have no sympathy for Stratfor, but to be clear, they are collateral damage here in this. Basically, the FBI allowed the destruction of this private consulting firm for the purpose of trying to get Julian Assange on some kind of a crime. And that needs to be made clear that they are creating this whole scenario so that they can accuse WikiLeaks of being involved in a crime. Ziggy, if I can mention the second individual,
yes.
His name is Ziggy Þórðarson, and he's from Iceland. And this is someone who is even
FBI more, informant too, by the way. Yeah,
a second FBI informant. He's apparently much, much more of a fabricator or liar than even Sabu. This guy is someone who, just a preface, when he did an interview with Wired magazine, they did a story on him. An important fact is that they were aware that he is such a habitual liar that they said after the interview, send us primary source documents so that you can prove what you've said, so we can check. We want to check records to show that what you just told us in this interview before we print it is actually true, because we know that you have a reputation of being a liar. And so Ziggy is someone who was given this. He was 17 at the time that he was given this role of being in charge of a chat room that WikiLeaks had. He was the first point of contact for any new volunteers, journalists, potential sources, or outside groups that wanted to talk with people at WikiLeaks. And that's what Wired said about him. He was fired because he was caught embezzling $50,000 from this merchandise store that was set up. And
WikiLeaks merchandise store.
Yeah, it was a WikiLeaks
he
merchandise store.
He embezzled from
store.
WikiLeaks. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a merchandise store that WikiLeaks set up in order to encourage its supporters to help give them funds to promote their journalism or for their journalism. And, you know, Assange was aware that this is a person who was obviously going through a lot of mental health issues, it would seem. Didn't seem like he was completely sound in the mind. And but he did go
to
the
prison now for being a pedophile.
Yeah, there are multiple crimes that he was sentenced for. He was convicted of promising people, children between the ages of 15 and 20, cars and money in exchange for sexual favors.
15 and 17. At 20, you're not a child, but it's 15 and 17. Yeah.
Yeah. So this happened, and essentially when he was terminated from his position at WikiLeaks, he ended up begging the FBI for money because he realized, you know, he was now out of the loop and he had nothing to really fall back on. The FBI had been working through him while he was in charge of the chat room. So eventually he does get the FBI to cave and promise him $5,000. He makes some trips to Alexandria, Virginia, which is where this grand jury is impaneled. And he goes there and he apparently gives them some testimony that probably forms part of this new expanded indictment.
Well, now that's very interesting that you say because that was a question I was going to ask you, that he was an FBI informant while he was working for WikiLeaks, because while he was working for WikiLeaks, as you know, being in charge of their chat room, he approached Hector, okay, aka Sabu, about hacking Icelandic government systems, right? And
I think that he's definitely involved. He's one of these people who is interacting with Hector. They know each other, and in fact, it's pointed out that Hector was in contact with a person named Q. Ziggy went by the moniker of Q, and so he's definitely a part of this. So, you know, you've got the FBI, whether they actually know it or not. Sometimes, you know, it's hard to tell because there's incompetence, and then there's actual like calculated operations that go on. You don't know if like one handler had an informant and another handler had an informant, and they just so happened to interact with each other. You don't know if like he was on one operation and then you had Hector on a separate operation. And also keep in mind that Hector's involved in the digital space, whereas like this could probably spill over more outside and not necessarily be confined to the cyber world, because you know, Ziggy can move about and interact with these people. He's in Iceland, and we know that there are WikiLeaks associates that came and went from Iceland. And so he might have had more personal interactions, whereas it appears that Hector, everything that we know from Hector is happening through his interactions in internet relay chats and in private message boards, etc., in encrypted chats. And so we don't know that they're actually aware of each other, the FBI agents that are managing these paid informants.
Right. But go ahead, Celia.
Hi, this is Celia here. Fascinating discussion, and you two both are into stuff that is incredibly detailed and important, but I just want to pull back the lens a little bit and ask you, for example,
I'm having a hard time hearing you, Celia.
Oh, no. Okay. All right. Is that any better? Is that any better?
Yeah, it's a little clearer.
I'm up in the country, but I'm leaning out my window trying to get a good signal. Is that any better? No? Okay. I'll tell you what. I'll just turn it back to you, Christina, and I'll see if I can get to a better part of the
signal.
Say what
you were going to say, because, you know, it's good to pull back.
Yeah. So here's what I wanted. So the only aspect of this that I have personally investigated was the Sweden aspect. Many years ago, I wrote a piece. I'm half Swedish, so I was able to read the 100-page criminal complaint in Swedish, and it totally shocked me. There was, of course, as you know, as most people know now, no non-consensual sex, so on and so forth. The whole thing was a point of tension about how Julian Assange taking an HIV test on a Saturday in Stockholm. What I can't work out is why did Sweden play such a dark and central role in this whole thing? Why? What is the role of, they really caused a lot of the original problems, and they, I think, are much more complicit in this whole thing than they, and now they've kind of drifted off and they don't get mentioned much anymore. Can you just address that, your understanding of why did Sweden get up to this thing in its eyeballs?
Yeah. So I think they are involved in this as much as they have been because of their close alliance with the United States government, and potentially their alliance with the United Kingdom's government, which the United Kingdom is very, very close to the United States government and to the intelligence agencies and the U.S. government. And so You know, essentially, if you want to pull back any even further, what you have is a kind of mass conspiracy against Assange and the wider WikiLeaks organization that winds up being perpetrated in maybe more so in recent years for this fourth country. But you've got Sweden, the UK, the US, and Ecuador in the last 3 years being involved in making it possible to arrest and expel Assange and get him into a position where he could be taken into custody and then potentially extradited from the UK to the United States and put on trial. And so for Sweden, I think it has a lot to do with the way in which it does not want to offend the officials who have it as their priority to go after and nail WikiLeaks. And what we find in the case, the sexual allegations that were brought against Assange in Sweden, what we find is extreme improprieties on the part of prosecutors, where you basically have a starting and stopping and a starting and stopping and then a starting and stopping. It was like three times that it was open against Assange, and at no point did it get to get fully through the questioning phase of collecting testimony from the alleged suspect. And you basically have, even after they have dropped the case, you still have Sweden, its prosecution authority, continuing this narrative of Assange as the rape suspect. And it's led UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Meltzer, to use very direct language in singling Sweden out, because what they've done really fed this public mobbing that has been able to unfold against Assange, and I think tamp down and diminish the kind of support that people have for what he was doing as a publisher. And so without the prosecutors actually bringing charges, you then have an endless debate about whether this did or did not happen. And then that sullies the reputation of someone who had gained some praise and prestige from publishing these disclosures from Chelsea Manning that were hugely impactful against the U.S. government. It's also pointed out by Nils Meltzer that Sweden doesn't have a great record when it comes to allowing CIA to conduct renditions in Sweden. They have their own human rights abuses to account for, although they are much smaller in scale than the United States. You know, they are complicit in allowing the abuse of people who were within their own country. And so that factors into this as well, when you are trying to assess why does Sweden do this to Julian Assange.
You know, it's so interesting that you're providing those details, because what you really have is the United States that is leading trying to lead a legal charge that, and being supported, you know, the Australians haven't done anything to help Julian, you know. And, you know, obviously, they're apparently, aren't there things going on in the court related to the CIA surveilling Julian in the Ecuadorian embassy, which is illegal?
Yes.
I mean, there was pressure brought on the Ecuadorians, you know, is it one of those, you can just imagine it, sort of the plata or plomo, you know, silver money silver or lead scenario in terms of getting rid of Assange so that he would be exposed. And now you have this barrister, the judge in the current, in the current proceedings in the UK. I mean, this woman, she's behaved. I mean, she's crossed the line so many times. It's just ridiculous. So all these countries are helping the U.S. do this, and you can only imagine that it's because all these so-called democracies or Western nations or whatever, they're all seeing the writing on the wall. If Julian Assange and his kind are allowed to live, they're not going to be able to engage in their, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors as easily and get away with it with no accountability. I mean, this is why we're in the situation we're in here in the United States at this point, because, you know, no accountability for so much. But, you know, the bigger picture is terrifying, and you get the sense of these proceedings as being sort of a long-term, time-wasting, you know, using questionable, sometimes even criminal, crossing the line, illegal, engaging in illegal maneuvers to reach the end, which is to kill Assange and any WikiLeaks-type organizations, you know, kill WikiLeaks and any organization that comes up after it. I mean, is that how you're seeing it?
I don't think you're being hyperbolic at all. Part of the asylum request in its evidence contained examples of death threats that were made on news broadcasts by current and former government officials. And so those were entered into a record. They convinced Rafael Correa, when he was president of Ecuador, to grant Julian Assange asylum. And then now you have the government of the United States in the best position possible, because there's a global pandemic that has not gone away, that continues to wreck certain countries that haven't taken certain steps in order to protect their populations. And you see that in this Belmarsh prison where he is being held in confinement, because he was denied bail, because Vanessa Barrancher, the magistrate court judge, refuses to allow him out into home confinement, which is what should happen. He completed his sentence. By the way, just to make sure we work this in here, he was extraordinarily prosecuted for jumping bail and violating bail because he sought asylum from Ecuador. And once they had him in custody, he was convicted and sentenced to 50 weeks, which is very near the maximum. And yep, that's alarming in its own right, because most people wouldn't get that much time for jumping bail. He completed this term, and he was not allowed out of jail while he awaits the culmination of his extradition proceedings. And this is going to be long and drawn out. So while you have the potential that we already know that his health was deteriorating remarkably, that he endured psychological torture while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy. There's clear documentation of the kind of pressure campaign that the Ecuador government, with the support of the CIA, was engaged in the past 2 to 3 years before he was finally expelled and arrested in 2019. So he's in this prison. Prisons are notorious for not giving good health care. It's a maximum security prison. He is essentially in conditions of solitary confinement, probably, or something close to isolation, but maybe not as bad as what you would get in the United States, because you're protecting people from the spread of this virus. So he doesn't get sunlight. He's got limited ability to exercise, probably, and probably not getting very good food. Who knows about access to water? I'm not sure. And so I think if you're a U.S. official, you might be hoping that he would just die in this facility and that you don't ever have to get to the stage where you put him on trial in the United States and have to work out these messy issues of whether he should be protected under the First Amendment or not, which obviously I believe he should. But, you know, they're not really on solid ground when you look at their legal case. It isn't. But the thing is, they're shielded by an extradition process that's hugely favorable to the United States. That's very hard for his defense to win and overcome. So even if he would win at trial in the United States and prevail, because this is uncharted territory, and I don't know if they would succeed or not, but we just admit that this is kind of a first of its kind case if it happened in the United States. No matter what, you still have that 4 or 5 years in the UK that they're going to be able to continue to press onward until this phase happens in the United States. There are three stages at least in the UK that this extradition will move through, and that's a long time. I mean, Assange is 49, just turned 49. He could be 54 or 55 by the time he gets to the United States. And then also by that time, you know, who knows what condition he'll be in mentally and physically.
You know, I just had this sort of reptilian thought, you know, that, okay, so what happens? Because 4 or 5 years, it doesn't feel like he's going to last that long. I mean, we had Niels on our show, and he was talking about him. That was months ago, and he was saying, I mean, he's really not in good shape, you know. And I just thought, oh, it's so interesting, because another new thing in the superseding indictment are unindicted co-conspirators who also work for WikiLeaks. So that's the first time they've also gone after other people in WikiLeaks, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so, I mean, they haven't indicted them. They haven't, you know, done anything, but they've mentioned them. Okay. So my question is, you know, I wonder if that's happening because Assange is starting to fail. His health is starting to seriously fail. And then my other question to you, that's one question. What do you think? And what do you think if Assange does die? Then what happens? What happens to WikiLeaks? What happens? What do you see?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a larger question about what's WikiLeaks if Assange would pass on. It's very bleak. But to get to the co-conspirators thing, and I'll come back to your second question, I don't believe that there's a lot of evidence at this point that they will be indicted, but I think probably naming them in that indictment sends a clear message to them that they have something to fear, and that if they don't want to live in fear anymore, they should consider becoming cooperating witnesses with the U.S. government, and then they won't have to hide out. Two of the individuals are only one of them is an American. Jacob Applebaum is someone who spoke at the Hope Conference on behalf of WikiLeaks. This is a hacker conference, and he's also known as someone who was part of development for Tor before he was forced out. But Jacob is in Germany and believes that is potentially good enough to protect him from being prosecuted. So he has effectively fled the United States and been living outside the U.S. for several years. Sarah Harrison is someone who was a section editor for WikiLeaks. She's named as a co-conspirator, and she was involved in helping Edward Snowden, who was a Guardian source, as well as a source for the Washington Post and a source for The Intercept. And she went to Hong Kong and helped him, helped do source protection, helped to ensure that he could travel and get to asylum. They were headed towards a Latin American country. They were in the Sheremetyevo airport in Moscow and got trapped when the State Department revoked his passport. But she stayed with him and made sure that he was safe and then left. And so they're going after her and criminalizing her acts and also Julian Assange's support for doing that to protect a source from enduring what Chelsea Manning went through. I mean, all along we've had Edward Snowden's case as an example of what a person does so that they could avoid being taken into custody and enduring the kind of torture that Chelsea Manning went through. That was recognized by, I believe, Neil's predecessor, Juan Mendez. And so to your other question about what happens now, What happens with all of these people? I should mention that Daniel Domscheitberg, who was a spokesperson for WikiLeaks, he is a German. He lives in Germany. It's probably unlikely that he would be pursued for extradition, although he definitely has a lot of engaged in acts that the government could actively criminalize. So this question of Assange, what happens if he dies? What would happen to WikiLeaks? It's my view that it would probably just be continued. I mean, I think that there would be a legacy that the organization would have to carry on. I mean, right now it has a editor-in-chief, Kristin Hrafnsson, who is a from Iceland, and there have been publications at WikiLeaks that haven't been as big of – they haven't created as many shockwaves as the earlier leaks, but I think that has more to do with the kinds of sources. It probably has – you know, I think regardless of whether Julian Assange is alive or happens to die in prison, I think there's a larger question of, you know, how closely are the U.S. intelligence agencies monitoring WikiLeaks, and how capable are they of disrupting the passing of documents to this media organization, and how have they been able to succeed in discouraging potential sources from providing information to WikiLeaks because of the sort of examples they've been able to make of people like Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, but then also what they've been able to do to the journalists that are involved in publishing this information at WikiLeaks. So, you know, I think there might be a lot of information out there that, you know, maybe we haven't read certain documents in the last 5 years because there was a fear of what would happen because the U.S. government was monitoring WikiLeaks so closely.
So talk about journalist Barrett Brahm. Talk about what happened to him.
Well, so, I mean, he was charged. He was accused of sharing, he was caught up in this thing related to Stratfor tangentially. He was accused of sharing private identifying information and compromising credit cards and stuff of that nature. With the FBI focused on him, he also got caught on camera making a threat to an FBI agent during a live stream.
What threat was that? What was the threat? What was the threat?
Well, he was, that's how they twisted what he said, but he talked about wanting to come after the FBI, because he was, you know, being put under a microscope, and they after, and they wanted to go after his mother in order to turn her against him because she apparently took one of his computers and hid it under the sink, in their kitchen or trying to, prevent the agents when they raided from, getting this computer, at least that's their allegation. So they tried to turn his mom against him. And then he went through and he did serve time. He served time in prison. He was in a prison and facility in Texas for a while. He's free now. He's no longer in prison, but he was a journalist who was involved in this kind of work. Not different. Assange has looked at Barrett Brown and seen what happened to Barrett Brown as a kind of preview of what could happen to him. Because
Barrett Brown just receive the material from the hackers? I mean, wasn't that the deal? Was he actually involved in the breaches, in like the Stratfor hack?
I
don't get it.
They didn't charge him with that. They charged him with they charged him with violating, I believe it was the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that they charged him with. They didn't go after him for publishing any material that we would have read. They were basically going after him for, the exchange of these like passwords that they're always very technical because they want to get down to a supposed like nitty gritty in all of these cases. It's always about trying to find something in which they could undermine any solidarity for people who would typically deserve support. And so they want to pull out what they see as real crimes and separate it from the fact that it's a politically motivated prosecution in which they're trying to go after someone for engaging in journalism that's adversarial against them, and they want to take these individuals out so they no longer have the kinds of do the kinds of work that they're doing. And you know, they are willing to, both Barrett and Julian are journalists willing to accept material from hackers. They are engaging in journalism in its purest form. They do not care about the source. They do not ask questions about the sources. Julian has said time and time again that he looks at the documents and their contents, does a lot of forensics to verify their authenticity. He's proudly stated that they have a track record of never fabricating or getting the information wrong.
That is true.
And once they verify, then they publish. And I think that's hugely alarming to the United States because there's no gatekeeping on the part of WikiLeaks, whereas the U.S. government has its own people that it can use to contact New York Times editors, or they can contact Washington Post editors, and they can walk them through what intelligence agencies do, and they can try to tell them not to publish. You know, to some degree, The Intercept has done this as well. There's none of this with WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is going to publish. If it looks like they can verify it and authenticate it, and if it looks like it connects to something that's a public issue, then they're going to put that material out there. And they're going to put the whole cache. They're going to put it all out there so that they can't be accused of selectively picking certain parts. So, you know, one of the more polarizing releases in the last years, but it's not part of this indictment at all, were those Clinton campaign emails. But imagine if Julian Assange has just selected like 200 of them and held back the vast majority. I mean, people would have suggested he was not being fair to the campaign. So he put it all out. He put the whole cache of emails out, and everyone could make their own decision about how they viewed those documents. And then those documents are available for journalists like myself to dig into and do research. And, you know, the last thing I'll say to WikiLeaks' credit is we have so many sets of documents that are on the WikiLeaks website that can be used for research, for better understanding U.S. foreign policy and U.S. military operations, and they continue to be referenced today by scholars, and they'll continue to be referenced in the future because they're one of the best and most complete pictures of how the United States government engages in its conduct as a superpower in the world.
Yeah, yeah. No, I also want to go back to Barrett for a minute because, you know, he was he's forced to pay Stratfor, apparently. Is this true? $900,000 in restitution? And meanwhile, wasn't it Sabu who actually hacked Stratfor? No, it wasn't. Who was it that actually hacked Stratfor?
Well, I mean, as we've been discussing, he was suggesting it as a target or volunteering it.
Well, isn't this somebody called Heria or something like that, the actual hacker of Stratfor? The FBI knows who the actual Stratfor hacker is, but seems to be protecting that person, and instead they're having Barrett pay $900,000 to Stratfor?
Yeah, so to the issue of paying restitution, and you know, I even spoke to him after he got out of prison, and he was involved in publishing columns at The Intercept, and they wanted to come after him for money because he was having stuff published by The Intercept, they wanted to target him, and they're very aggressive in making sure that he couldn't go on to publish a book and bring in money from the book that didn't go directly back to the government. This is what they do to people. So beyond prison, this is how they also continue their pursuit.
What about this Heria guy, the actual hacker? What about him? or yeah, her, or whatever. Where is this person? Who is this person? I understand they're part of a group of hackers infiltrating the Syrian government or something, but what's up with that? Why hasn't that guy...
That's a perfectly good question. I unfortunately don't have an answer for you, but it's very clear that there is a whole bunch of activity that has been allowed to go on, and it's selectively prosecuted. And we know in these cases that they pick and choose what they're going to prosecute, and that's the game.
Yeah, because they're not even the FBI, neither the prosecutors nor the FBI have ever acknowledged Hiriya, or however you pronounce that name. They've never acknowledged whether or not that hacker has been captured, okay? And, you know, they go directly to Barrett to give $900,000 in restitution when he... It's crazy. And apparently they also lied to the New York Times about how everything with Stratfor went down, you know? So, I mean, it's all here in this document, in this superseding indictment. I mean, we're just journalists talking about this. What's going to happen when this gets to the courts? Although I have to tell you, I don't have a warm fuzzy feeling when I see that, you know, judges are allowing the FBI to, you know, conceal information, or, you know, like the countries the governments of the countries that were, or the countries whose governments were hacked by Sabu, you know. I mean, don't you think this is a document that can be picked apart by any criminal lawyer worth their salt?
The entire case is a conspiracy theory that's been concocted by the Justice Department against Julian Assange. And I know we are out of time. I'll just say that there's really no way he would get a fair trial in the U.S. because he's charged under the Espionage Act. He can't really talk about why he disclosed the information, because that's the way that the government prosecutes. So all they would really have to prove is that it happened and there were violations of secrecy law, which, by the way, he's a foreign citizen, and I don't think you should have to obey U.S. secrecy regulations if you're a foreign person.
Right, right. Right, exactly. That's a very interesting observation. Very interesting. I'm sure his lawyers have brought that up, right?
They should. And they should also focus on, and they have, that the government doesn't want to give him First Amendment rights.
Listen, Kevin, we are out of time. It's been a fascinating conversation with you, and we really appreciate having you on. And, you know, we look forward to having you on again sometime.
All right, thank you.